From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A day after gunshots shook the heart of the usually quiet Canadian capital of Ottawa, the city's police chief said the multiple attacks were the work of a lone gunman who was himself killed in the Parliament building. Chief Charles Bordeleau of the Ottawa Police told Canadian media Thursday that a search of the city's downtown, with much of the area under lockdown until late Wednesday, found no sign of any accomplices. Early police reports had said that there might be up to three armed men involved. That led to a room-by-room search of the Parliament buildings, as well as of nearby office buildings where thousands of workers were locked in. Many members of Parliament were not released from security areas in the main building until nearly 10 hours had passed. Despite the fact that only one reportedly disturbed person was involved in an apparently small arms attack, given the media hype around the incident, some are concerned it will be used to roll back basic human rights in Canada, as has happened in the U.S. post-9/11. Among those so concerned is former MI5 agent Annie Michon, who spoke with RT's Matt Trezza on Thursday.
Well, if they're aiming at a government building, then obviously they do have some sort of political motivation behind them. But I think it's too early at this stage to try and speculate about what that would be. Let's not forget, for example, the attack and the bombing in Oklahoma in America in 1995. And all the initial media reports were that Al-Qaeda or Islamic extremists had carried this out. And in fact, it turned out that a domestic extremist, Timothy McVeigh, had carried out the attack. And similarly as well with the downing of MH17, the Malaysian flight over Ukraine. Immediately, everyone jumped to the assumption that it must be Russian separatists armed by Russia who carried out the attack. And of course, the only way to establish what really happens is for a thorough forensic investigation and an evidential case-building study after the attack when people can work out what happened, hopefully gather evidence and put people on trial in front of a jury of their peers. That would be the sane, logical, and actually mature response within a mature democracy. So I hope that the Canadians will do that rather than using this as yet another pretext for stripping away the civil liberties and increasing surveillance and policing of the Canadian people.
So based on your experience with British intelligence, what do you think Canadian intelligence officials, what steps are they going through right now?
Well, it'll be a linkage between the police and also the intelligence agencies. So they will be trying to secure the crime scenes, trying to arrest any further perpetrators that might be out there, and gathering the forensic information. But once they identify the perpetrators, they need to work out who they are, what their potential affiliations might be, who their networks potentially might be, and what their motivation is. So it's very much an evidential gathering process, rather than hopefully not a hysterical over-response politically, which suddenly says, oh, we've got to spy on everybody, and this is justification for dragnet surveillance.
An update in the case of the 43 disappeared students in the Mexican city of Iguala, where protesters have burned down City Hall. We have this report from Press TV.
Mexican authorities say the mayor of the southern town of Iguala ordered a police raid that resulted in the disappearance of dozens of students last month.
An arrest warrant has been issued for the mayor of Iguala, Jose Luis Abarca, his wife Pineda Avila, and the Secretary of Public Security as probable intellectual authors of the acts committed in Iguala on September 26.
Mexico's Attorney General said Iguala police were ordered by the mayor to prevent students from disrupting a political event. The students were protesting to raise funds for their college. Police opened fire on the students' buses, killing six people. 43 others were declared missing in the following days. Meanwhile, thousands of teachers and students rallied in Iguala on Wednesday in a display of rage over the unsolved disappearance. Some protesters torched the City Hall building. Well, to get the latest on that, we're now joined by Alistair Baverstock, who's Press TV's correspondent currently in Mexico City. Alistair, I would imagine that there's widespread anger because this case almost reads like a novel that a mayor would order police to attack students.
Well, this is a story that just keeps getting worse and worse for the authorities that have been involved. on not only the authorities' involvement in what has gone on, but also the revelations that have come out about this mayor and about these authorities for many, many years beforehand. I spoke the other day to the wife of Arturo Cardona, who was an activist who was killed and who was murdered in 2013, and this wife is claiming that it was the mayor himself who came to the place where they'd been taken, took up a shotgun and shot him himself, and that she's been trying for years and years to bring this man to justice, and that only now that these allegations are coming out that the man is finally, well, he's on the run but also being sought.
So has the mayor, through any channel, responded to these allegations?
The mayor, we have not heard of him since the 26th of September, the 27th, when he fled the town of Iguala. And it's been since then that these allegations have come out that his wife is a family member of some of the most powerful people in this Guerreros Unidos cartel, which have supposedly committed these acts. And in terms of the mayor speaking out, he's been AWOL ever since these events have occurred.
And so finally, what are we realistically expecting to happen going forward? Are we realistically expecting to find these 43 students alive? Are we realistically expecting this mayor to be put on trial and to be held accountable?
Well, in terms of the mayor being held accountable, I think following this scandal, it's certain that if he is found, he will be held accountable for the acts that he's done, purely for the scandal. But in terms of finding these students, all the parents, all the people who are out there searching for them remain positive. They're saying, yes, we do believe that they're still alive and we want them returned. But given Iguala's history and the huge amount of death and the amount of violence that has gone on there, I think the consensus is more and more now that the students will not be coming back alive.
As we reported earlier this week, Syria's permanent ambassador to the United Nations, Bashar al-Ja'afari, issued a call to the United Nations Tuesday to punish what he called the, quote, terrorist coalition of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Israel, closed quote, which he said seeks to destroy Syria. This is the ambassador's complete statement to the Security Council Tuesday through a UN translator.
Shukran.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Mr. President. President, allow me to start with a number of questions. How long are we going to keep simply meeting here to make statements which express concern, condemnation, refusal of Israel's continued occupation of Arab territories in Palestine, in the Golan, and the South Lebanon? This occupation, unprecedented occupation in its length, violation of international law, its policy of settlements, which have all destroyed any glimmer of hope of building the Palestinian state which all of us yearn for, and to seeing global comprehensive peace prevail. It's always disregarded, all the meetings which take place here in this international organization, the resolutions we undertake here, even though Israel itself was created by a Security Council resolution. So this disregard by Israel of the United Nations and its ongoing persecution of the Palestinian people and its occupation of Arab land, including, of course, the occupation of the Syrian Golan, is based on the irresponsible backing which is lent it by a number of influential member states of this council, both at political as well as military and media levels. President, some claim, and they do this, whether it be in the morning, in the afternoon, or at night, that they're concerned with the Palestinian people and Syria, and their fallacious words are now known to all, especially concerning the condemnation of the Israeli occupation of the Syrian Golan, which has been occupied since 1967. It almost leads us to believe that reacquiring the Syrian Golan is not part of our natural rights. We're almost led to believe that this is not Syrian-occupied land, or that Syrians who are suffering under Israeli occupation aren't members of the Syrian people as a whole. This, in this foray, where we always praise international human rights and international law, but where are those same people when it comes to putting an end to the Israeli settlement campaigns, as well as the suffering of Syrian citizens, which have been going on now for close to half a century? Where are their noble words and noble intentions when these citizens suffer from policies of repression, of racial discrimination, torture, when they're deprived of their natural resources, including, of course, oil, gas, and water? President, the most recent developments in the region, which have pushed UNDOF to evacuate some of its positions on a provisional basis, are not just coincidence. No, they have come at the right time to confirm, to reaffirm what we had warned against, that the support lent by certain regimes, including Israel, to Al-Qaeda-related groups in the area of separation is not only a flagrant violation of the disengagement agreement and, of course, of international law, as well as all of the Security Council's resolutions, but it also exposes the United Nations forces to a threat and makes them unable to discharge their mandate. And this is what happened when these terrorist groups repeatedly kidnapped peacekeepers, members of UNDOF, or have fired against these soldiers or indeed their positions, which prompted them to evacuate some of these aforementioned positions under the threat of fire. In coordination, or rather should I say, and this under a process of coordination with a regime which sponsors terrorism and which claims that it is a mediator, but it does this to cover the fact that it pays bribes and ransom money to terrorists, and this is inadmissible. What we cannot understand is that every single warning, all information which we had communicated repeatedly to all the parties, the United Nations and others, including Israeli support to terrorist groups and the fact that Syrian positions were being targeted in a direct way, was all disregarded. But we had shared this information, and this is done to help these groups to achieve their ends. Or what about the request we had submitted to officially investigate the possible collusion between Qatari intelligence services and the kidnapping of UNDOF peacekeepers, especially those who are members of the Filipino contingents. These terrorist groups continue to act based on their belief, their conviction that the United Nations aren't even going to lift the little finger to intervene, and that Israel will continue to lend them all logistical military support, and that Qatar is going to keep paying millions of dollars in ransom money to release those who have been detained, and this within the framework of something which is nothing more than a masquerade aimed at justifying the financing of the Al-Nusra Front after the new constraints and limitations imposed upon them after Resolution 2170 regarding the prohibition on the financing of ISIS and the Al-Nusra Front. This doesn't, however, exempt Qatar of its legal responsibility, because this is a flagrant violation of Resolution 2133 of this very council, which bans the payment all ransom to terrorist outfits. It is high time for the United Nations to come into play, to put an end to the Turco-Saudi collusion aimed at shedding Syrian blood and which promotes the Judaization of Israel, of Jerusalem. We'd like to reaffirm our ongoing position, which backs the right of the Palestinian people to self-determination and the building of an independent state throughout its whole territory with Jerusalem as its capital, while guaranteeing the right of refugees to return to their lands, to their homes, in keeping with Resolution 194, dated 1948. This is a non-negotiable right. This is a right which will never disappear or evaporate. This is something which is reaffirmed by international law and United Nations resolutions and all international relevant instruments. Syria condemns the Israeli violence against the Palestinian people in the Gaza Strip. This is yet another new chapter in the overall plot and the overall aggression against the Palestinian people. Israel's continuation of such acts of aggression has exacerbated tension in the region. They have reached an unprecedented level, one which will have very heavy consequences, which of course will not be limited to the region alone. This is why we call upon the United Nations, including Security Council, to bear their responsibilities by putting an end to the Israeli occupation and to put an end to the barbaric policy of continued aggression, forcing Israel to withdraw from all occupied Arab lands to the line of the 4th June of 1967, in keeping with relevant United Nations resolutions, including 242, 338, and 397 of the Security Council. Mr. President, we're again today witnessing reiterated attempts or repeated attempts by the United States and its allies aimed at killing off the very hope, embedded in this discussion, the title of this discussion, the situation in the Middle East. And this is being done to cover the Israeli crimes and its ongoing violations of international law by drawing away attention from these very facts. The policies of these states, headed by the United States, by the UK, by Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and others, violate the provisions of the United Nations Charter and the rules of international law. By resorting to the use of terrorism and defamation as tools to combat the Syrian state, including through the building, or should I say, the creation of training camps for terrorists, for mercenaries, by claiming that this is the moderate opposition. And then they send them into the Syrian interior, crossing the borders of our borders with neighboring countries. And this, of course, is all a violation of all the resolutions of this council regarding counterterrorism. The statements made by delegations have revealed that the very same states which back terrorism in my country, Syria, are also working to protect Israel, attempting to ensure that it never faces embarrassment and covering up its crimes. The United Nations have not just used the right of veto 61 times to protect Israel and to prolong its occupation of our territories, which suffer under its occupation. No, the United States have even disregarded Security Council resolutions in the past to forge illegal alliances targeting the sovereignty of a great many member states of this organization. These illegitimate alliances, which were forged by the United States and the United Kingdom outside the confines of this council, have resulted in nothing more but violence, discretion, anarchy, and terrorism throughout the world. And this came at the cost of respect for the rules of international law and human rights. I thank you, sir.
Tuesday also saw an about-face from Turkey on the issue of providing aid to Kurdish forces fighting ISIS, as Ankara sought to deflect allegations that it had been assisting anti-government terrorists in Syria. Abiyomi Ezekwe is the publisher of the Pan-African Newswire and a frequent CPR contributor. He spoke with RT's Matt Trezza Tuesday.
The Kurdish government is under tremendous pressure surrounding this situation, because simply the allegations that have been leveled that they have been involved in supplying material and logistical support to the Islamic State fighters that were on the verge of seizing control of this important border town in Kobani. And also, the Kurdish fighters have been making tremendous strides over the last couple of weeks in beating back the Islamic State seizure of the city. So what it's illustrating is that the U.S., which is now is doing airlifts of weapons to the Peshmergas, the pressure by Washington on Ankara is very substantial, and consequently, this can speak to the shift, the apparent shift, at least in word, of the position of the Kurdish, of the Turkish government in response to the Kurdish fighting against the IS in Kobani.
Syria has been gripped by deadly violence since 2011. The U.S. and its regional allies, especially Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, have been actively supporting the anti-government fighters in that country. Wednesday saw a debate between four candidates running for the office of governor of the state of New York. The Democratic incumbent, Andrew Cuomo, faced off with Republican challenger Rob Astorino, Green Party candidate Howie Hawkins, and Libertarian Michael McDermott in Buffalo, New York. Among the entertainment highlights of the evening was a section of the debate which began with a question asked of the incumbent governor by New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez, who is also the co-host of Democracy Now! Gonzalez asked the governor about an announced federal probe into allegations that he interfered in the operations of an anti-corruption committee that he created.
Good evening. Mr. Cuomo, in 2013, you appointed a special panel, the Moreland Commission, to root out corruption in Albany. But you suddenly abolished your own panel less than a year ago, and press accounts say your aides pressured its members to squash certain investigations. Manhattan U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara is now probing what happened. How do you respond to those who call this the darkest stain of your first term? And can you assure us tonight that your office never sought to interfere with the Moreland Commission or any attorney general investigations prompted by it, or even the current federal probe?
Mr. Cuomo, you have 1 minute.
Yes, I can. And I thank you for bringing it up because there's been a lot of misinformation, and this is an opportunity to clear it up. Two basic points. Number one, we appointed a commission, and I said to the chairman of the commission, who happens to be the preeminent district attorney in the state of New York, in my opinion, happens to be a Republican, Chairman Fitzpatrick, you make all the decisions. Yes, people gave him advice. He had public hearings. My staff talked to him. Everyone's staff talked to him. But he has repeatedly said he made all the decisions independently. He's been saying that for months in numerous mediums. Second, there was no abrupt stopping. I wanted the commission to get a law passed. That's why I impaneled it. I said to the legislature, when you pass the law, the commission will go away. They passed the law. The law has an independent enforcement agent, redefined bribery, was applauded by all the DAs, and that's what we needed, was a new law so the DAs could actually prosecute. And that's what we produced.
Mr. Hawkins, you have 1 minute.
When I'm governor, I would re-impanel the Moreland Commission on Public Corruption and let it follow through on the investigations it began and complement what the U.S. Attorney Preet Bharara is doing. To deal with the underlying problem of our pay-to-play culture, where you get big campaign contributions and outside income for legislators in order to open the doors for special interests to get tax breaks and favors, I favor a system of full public campaign financing where everybody makes a reasonable number of $5 contributions and gets their petitions done, and then they get an equal grant. And they have to participate in a series of public debates. And you know who's running on 100% clean money and who's still getting the old dirty money. What's been passed in the legislature and what Mr. Cuomo's been advocating is a system of partial public campaign financing where you have a limited amount of public campaign financing that's matching funds and still unlimited private funding. That's just a reform that doesn't reform, puts a little public money on top of the old system that needs to be changed. And then the legislators should be banned from taking outside income. They should work full time for us as legislators, as public servants.
Mr. McDermott, you have 1 minute.
You know, I've been watching TV. I see all sorts of commercials from one side or the other. The Democrats accusing the Republicans of corruption, the Republicans accusing the Democrats of corruption. I tend to think they're probably both right. And I'll tell you, I'm tired of it. I'm tired of listening to it. I don't want to hear about this stuff. If you want to have a Moreland Commission, somebody independent, who do you trust to have the answer? We've got to get people back into the process. New Yorkers have to be part of the process, and New Yorkers have to decide for themselves who's corrupt, who's not corrupt. I know one thing. I'm not corrupt. I just want to represent the people. And we better start doing it, because I'm tired of all this negative ads. And we have so much work to do. As governor, I will make sure that there not only is there no corruption, but it's not the Democrat or Republicans that are where the solutions lie. The solution lies, they are part of the problem, they are the problem. The solution lies in getting the people involved in all of this kind of stuff. And that's my firm belief, that the people have to be empowered to start deciding for themselves who's corrupt and who's not.
Mr. Astorino, you have 60 seconds.
4 years ago, Andrew Cuomo pretended to be the reformer to come in, the white knight that was going to clean up the corruption in Albany. He called it an embarrassment, and he was right. Unfortunately, right now, he is swimming in the cesspool of corruption, so much so that we have a state where only in New York can the Anti-Corruption Commission have already been corrupted. And we have a U.S. attorney, Preparara, who just today said that Albany is a corruption disaster. So you're looking at Andrew Cuomo the rest of tonight. You will see a person who very well may be indicted after this election day comes and goes for witness tampering, obstruction of justice, failure to report crimes. We've seen this before in New York. It has to come to an end. And Governor, I would ask to you tonight if you would just talk to the people directly, tell them the truth, raise your right hand, swear that neither you nor your staff has been subpoenaed by the U.S. attorney with regard to the Moreland Commission scandal. I think that would set the record straight.
Mr. Gonzalez, I believe you have a follow-up question. For which candidate?
To Mr. Cuomo first, and the others can respond also, about the interview that Preparara did today. He also said in that interview, the only way an investigative body can get to the root of a problem is if it's independent. Mr. Cuomo, was the panel that you set up independent, and do you believe it has to be a panel has to be independent to get to the root of the problem?
Each candidate has 30 seconds. Mr. Cuomo.
Yes, and the chairman said that a number of times. As far as what Mr. Astorino said, I mean, it truly is outrageous. The U.S. attorney that he is now quoting said about Mr. Astorino that he's given numerous false and misleading lies. He's been ordered to give a videotaped statement for 7 hours under oath with a penalty of perjury. When a U.S. attorney says you've done numerous false and misleading statements, that's federal speak for you're lying. He's been charged with racketeering, which is being reviewed by the Manhattan DA, and he won't release his taxes. And I've been
an
AG.
Thank you, Mr. Cuomo.
When someone won't release
Mr. Cuomo,
taxes, there's a reason.
Mr. Hawkins, you have 30 seconds.
Well, I would just observe that Mr. Cuomo has said at times this Moreland panel was independent, and at other times it was a panel he created and he could shut it down. There's been an inconsistency there. And you have to wonder why he shut it down when he had said originally it was independent. And, you know, I hope the U.S. attorney is following through in his investigation.
Mr. McDermott, 30 seconds.
I feel like I just want to say I rest my case. I mean, here we go again. I mean, you know, one, who knows what the answer is? I'd like to believe that our government officials are not corrupt and that they really want to represent the people. I didn't hear the interview today because I was speeding along the highway from Albany to Buffalo to try to make this debate on time because I did not want to be late. I turned out to be the first one here. Independent? Absolutely. But who decides who the independent panel is? We have to get the people back into power. Let the people come in. I want to represent the people. The Libertarian platform is about people. It's about the Constitution. It's about doing what's right and what's fair.
Mr. Astorino, 30 seconds.
You know, a Democratic consultant for Andrew Cuomo once said that he would say anything and do anything, including lie, to get elected. You're hearing it tonight. You've seen it on TV with $21 million of completely negative and false ads. So there's only one person here that has a criminal defense team. It's not me. It's Andrew Cuomo. Now, why do you need a criminal defense team if you did nothing wrong? So once again, would you like to tell the people of New York whether you've been subpoenaed and your staff has been subpoenaed by the U.S. attorney?
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.